Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. All places around the globe have a gay history, but it's still a largely untold one, particularly in Wisconsin. The national narrative of gay history often involves events that took place on the coasts, the most recognizable being Stonewall. But according to scholar and activist Dick Wagner, there was a pre-Stonewall liberation for gays and lesbians forming identities and support networks in Wisconsin. His new book, We've Been Here All Along, examines Wisconsin's early gay history from 1895 to 1969. From press coverage of Oscar Wilde's trial, anti-vice crusades, to post-war medical labeling of homosexuality as an illness, Wagner dives deep into history to find the legacy and resilience of early gay Wisconsinites and their influence on the evolution of the state. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone from his home in Madison, ahead of an upcoming talk in Milwaukee. He begins by explaining why the early gay history of Wisconsin was worth his in-depth examination.
Dick Wagner, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk today.
Great, delighted.
So your book, We've Been Here All Along, gets into Wisconsin's early gay history. And by default, all cities and places around the globe have a gay history. So what makes Wisconsin's early gay history noteworthy to you?
What's noteworthy to me is that before Stonewall, you had gays and lesbians in Wisconsin figuring out their identities. They were forming networks of support, which basically is the same liberation that starts to occur greatly after Stonewall. And so you have a pre-Stonewall liberation occurring that is hardly known by folks either in the state or even beyond the state's boundaries.
Right. People don't often think about gay history, especially in the Midwest, much less what occurred on the various coasts in the United States.
Right, right. So, you know, the title We've Been Here All Along is a little stab at, you know, like gay history began before Stonewall, and gay history was not all on the East Coast with Stonewall riots in New York, nor all on the West Coast with the early homophile organizations that were founded out there.
And how did Wisconsin's climate fare compared to other states across the U.S.? I mean, in general, places were very homophobic, especially in early history and especially post-World War II, but what was Wisconsin like?
Well, Wisconsin had the whole apparatus of homophobia. It had legal prohibitions, it had police enforcement, it had the courts opining about how horrible the crime of sodomy was. And then after World War II, it had the whole medical apparatus of sickness that was applied. So Wisconsin had the whole basis of homophobia, which makes the remarkable brave stories of men and women who sorted out their lives positively even more remarkable.
Right. And with researching this book extensively, to have great primary documents, photos, what challenges did you face when collecting your research, and what sources did you end up going to back and back again?
I came across surprising resources, and learning how to interpret them, knowing the general writing about gay and lesbian history nationwide, gave me sort of frameworks to go look. The book by Alan Burby about coming out under fire had just one footnote about a Truax study in it that was done by a professor at the University of Wisconsin Medical School and a psychiatrist who was at the Truax Army Air Force Base. And so I actually dug out the study, and the study, while it was about endocrine theories of homosexuality, which was not proved by the study, nevertheless took some life histories of the gay men who were in the study. And one of the just sort of astounding things was that they all rejected the sickness description that had been applied for the medical screening of homosexuals out from World War II. And then there was this throwaway line that the researchers listed that four of them were members of a gay organization, and this was in 1945 here in Madison, Wisconsin. So that just sort of blew my mind that when you start tracking from sources that, you know, there's this sort of total resistance to the self-imposed homophobia that they're supposed to internalize.
And I imagine you needed to pay special attention to language, whether it was finding primary documents
right.
that were within gay groups in Madison and beyond. And the nature of your research with researching people during a period where evidence could be used against them. So finding those subtleties. So what did you find that were key instances or words to look out for, or what did you learn to like filter through in your mind?
Well, some of the visible folks were Bob Neal and Edgar Hellam in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. In the 1930s, the two of them bought these little Cornish cottages and started to fix them up and run an antique shop and then eventually sort of a Cornish meal operation out of these old homes. And there were lots of descriptions about them, and they talked about the partners. They didn't use a qualifier like business partners, but they also talked about artistic and about young men, even though they were middle-aged in terms of the lifespan of the period. So clearly these code words were being used to describe them. And you also get some other words that are less coded, like fairy or pixies or other things like that, that get applied to men in the pre-World War II period. So if you know what to look for, you can find the stuff.
With the structure of homophobia, the press certainly played a role in that. And I found it fascinating, you know, the power of language, whether that be in suppressing representation of people or recognition, even though most of the time it was negative, from where you start the book with Oscar Wilde's trial being covered in Wisconsin to beyond. With you as a researcher and a writer, how did you reflect upon use of language throughout all of the research you were doing?
I mean, it was interesting to see how people changed sort of positions. In the Vice study of the 1913-14 period, progressive sociologists roundly condemned permitting vice to be visible or seen in the communities. And then you had progressive sociologists in the 1930s beginning to talk about homosexuality not as a crime, but as a condition of people, and so they were exploring new theories, and the same with the studies right at the end of the war and following, is that, you know, they were showing that gay men and lesbians had actually served in the military services, even though the military had tried to screen them out. So the whole question about whether gay men and women could be patriotic or not, this whole part of that McCarthy period of the Lavender Scare. And in Wisconsin, there was resistance to that, as well as sort of admittedly hiding as well.
Right. And I did want to touch upon that with Senator Joe McCarthy being of one of Wisconsin's
yep.
you know, big historical figures. You found he was prosecuting gays more than communists, yet that wasn't getting as much attention in the press. You know, we think of McCarthyism, we think of communism being rooted out by any means possible. So what was this other side to it?
Well, McCarthy, in his own words, was quite against commies and queers. And one of the Republican bosses in the state urged the Republicans nationally to pick up the McCarthy charges because he was having an effect against homosexuals in government. So the whole apparatus, which was focused about trying to rid homosexuals out of government service, comes in with actually the Eisenhower administration. Previously, homosexuals might have been judged as a security risk on an individual basis, but with the McCarthy period and the Eisenhower executive order, it was a whole class of people just by their status that was considered a security risk. So you know, Wisconsin went through that as well. There were folks at Truax who were sort of bopped out of the military services. But many more nevertheless served and resisted that.
Another thing to touch upon that I feel is important is also along Wisconsin institutions, UW-Wisconsin's treatment of gay students. You know, we here at Milwaukee's NPR, we're under UW-Milwaukee, which is, of course, part of the bigger UW system.
Right.
So could you touch upon how the gay students were treated at UW-Wisconsin-Madison in particular when it comes to regards of therapeutic discipline and the 1962 purge? I feel like when people think of our college institutions, this is not touched upon a whole lot.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
The Madison campus initiated what they called, as you said, therapeutic discipline, where if someone was found out to be homosexual, and it was all men, that they were sent to psychiatrists because they were presumed to be sick and that maybe they could be adjusted or cured. Some of them played along with that because they wanted to get readmitted back into the university. Others simply said, no, I'm not sick. I don't want to go to the psychiatrist. So, but in those cases, they often lost financial support or were denied access to the School of Medicine or the College of Education because it wasn't thought those were appropriate roles for homosexuals to fill. There had been some earlier cases arising in Milwaukee at the Extension operation, which caused a Regents investigation, which listed a 1,000-page report. And there were concerns then raised over counseling of a potential lesbian student in the Milwaukee system, as well as there was a controversy that arose with the firing of the dean of the Extension system over in Milwaukee, who then charged that President Frank of the university and his backers in the Progressive Party were supporting immorality, including homosexual immorality, in that period. And the progressives and socialists in the state joined in the fight against that and beating back that attack.
Is that unique to Wisconsin history compared to other states who had similar things going on with Wisconsin's Progressive Party influence?
Right. This mini lavender scare in the 30s did not occur in many places. There was also, it was both a lavender and red scare in the 30s, and there were very few of those around the country. And to align the forces of the Progressive Party and the Socialist out of Milwaukee against that showed that they had moved from where they were in the pre-World War period, where they were all against suppressing vice. And in this case, they were sort of fighting against these sort of lavender scare charges that had been raised, in this case by conservative Democrats.
How did you find that people within the university were resilient in finding ways to fight back against what was happening?
Well, the remarkable thing is that you have the predominant narrative from homophobia that homosexuals are criminals or they're sick. And the way to counteract that was to try and get their own voices heard. It's similar to the post-Stonewall coming out experience of where telling your own stories is a way to contradict the assumptions, wrongheaded assumptions about gays and lesbians. And so by gay people participating in these studies by UW academics in the 30s and the 40s and into the 50s, they were trying to change the narrative by actually describing their own lives as not something quite so odd. And the other interesting thing was that in many of the comments, they would talk about not sex, but about love. And so that was also trying to change the definition, because the also other assumption and narrative was that, you know, homosexuals were all sex fiends, and of course heterosexuals were not sex fiends.
Right. I also want to bring attention to, you highlight a lot of people in your book. A couple on the front, Charlotte Partridge and Miriam Fink, have Milwaukee roots right here and founded Milwaukee's Layton School of the Arts. Could you describe to listeners a little bit of their story?
Sure. They met at Milwaukee Downer College, and female colleges were terrible breeding grounds for these sort of domestic friendships, which was the name for two women who would live together before lesbians became a popular name for that. And so they left their room at the college, which the college had provided them as part of their compensation, and moved off campus. And then they went on to found the Layton School for Arts in the basement of the Layton Galleries. They were very involved with the Work Progress Administration arts programs during the New Deal. And in fact, when Charlotte Partridge, who was more the artist of the group who had been running that, had to step down, her partner, Miriam Frink, stepped in for the while she was there. They were quite remarkable women. They were well known in Milwaukee's civic circles. They were on committees to honor Victor Berger's widow, Meta, who was very well known in the community as well. They built a house in suburban Thiensville and had a studio up on the north shore of Lake Michigan near Fox Point. And so here you had these two remarkable women leading their partnered life together in the public sphere of Milwaukee. They also encouraged gay artists at the Layton School for the Arts. So they were a remarkable couple.
One thing I noticed going through the book is, of course, the different way that gay men were affected by the goings-ons of the time versus lesbians. What are your observations on that? And is it the nature of history and the still yet limited roles women could play?
Yes, it was. Women's roles were circumscribed. And one of the conversations I had with one of the people who had reviewed the book was that women's sexuality was often discounted. And so, you know, men acting out sexually different was thought to be very dangerous, and women's sexuality was hardly noticed in so many ways back in those days. In fact, at one point, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that sort of the old statute against sodomy or crime against nature couldn't be applied to women because there was no male organ involved. Later, the legislature corrected that to change it to sexual perversion, which included both sexes. But again, that was just another example of how female sexuality was given a lesser prominence. One of the other things is that the Dean of Women on the Madison campus at the time of the gay purge in 1962 was a lesbian, and she wasn't interested in purging women students who might have been accused of lesbianism, and in fact the student discipline files don't show any of those kinds of cases. There were some 50 women who were disciplined for heterosexual violations and another 50 men who were disciplined for homosexual violations, but no lesbian violations.
What do you think is one of the most valuable lessons readers can take away from learning about Wisconsin's early gay history?
One of it is the agency of gays and lesbians themselves in establishing their lives and in establishing places where they could live and beginning to tell their stories. In other words, and this is the first volume of two volumes, and the second volume tells the remarkable story of how that early impulse for liberation in Wisconsin is fully realized when we become the first state to pass a gay rights law.
Well, Dick Wegner, thank you so much for your extensive work on this book. It certainly offers a lot of great insights. And thank you so much for the time you took to speak with me about it today.
Glad to do it, Audrey.
Dick Wegner is the author of We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and he'll be in town tomorrow evening to give a presentation about his book at UW-Milwaukee. You can find out more information about it at wuwm.com.